the opportunity to help them find it. One final thought. One of the best ways you can combat the evil of our world is to impart vision and values to your children. Why don't you consider painting a picture of what they can become and how they can contribute to their society? And don't forget to teach them what's important in life. I'm Dennis Rainey, and that's Real Family Life.
KPDQ Portland, a service of Salem Media Group. Listen online at TrueTalk800.com.
Wear a denture. Are you sure your breath is clean and fresh? Try Polident. It's specifically designed to clean a denture because it's tough on odor-causing bacteria, but gentle on the denture itself. Polident has a 4-in-1 cleaning system with 4 powerful ingredients that work together to deep clean your denture. It kills 99.99% of odor-causing bacteria in laboratory testing and helps to remove stains. Feel confident and clean every day with Polident. Available at Walmart for a low price every day.
Are you drowning in IRS tax debt?
I owe the IRS $37,000.
Get ready for a toll-free hotline. Take advantage of new IRS tax forgiveness programs that may protect you from IRS collection agencies. They have the power to garnish your wages, put liens on your property, and levy your bank account. Civic Tax Relief can help protect you from the IRS.
Civic Tax Relief basically represented me against the IRS, and by the time everything was completed, I didn't owe the IRS anything.
Find out about the Fresh Start program that is now available through Civic Tax Relief. Civic Tax Relief's special tax hotline can help you discover all the relief programs available for free.
I would recommend anyone who has a tax problem to contact Civic Tax Relief.
Just call 800-601-7780, 800-601-7780. Don't wait. Call now, 800-601-7780, 800-601-7780.
The men and women of America's Navy do some amazing things to make the world a better place. So can you. Whether it's by donating food or simply giving time, right in your own backyard.
To the Narrow Path radio broadcast. I got to turn down something here. And we are live, as usual, taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can call me here, and we will talk about them here. If you have a different viewpoint from the host, you can call here as well and talk about them. We do have our lines full right now, it looks like, so if you call at the moment, you'll probably get a busy signal. But if you do, take this number down and call later, and it'll be opening up. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And let's talk to who's been here the longest. Looks like it's Josh from Olympia, Washington. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Josh. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I just had a quick question. I went through kind of a...
I'm sorry?
Kind of felt like I had like an anxiety attack a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I've always trusted in the Lord, and I just was... curious. I'm familiar with the passage, and I believe it's in Philippians 4, where it talks about casting your anxieties on Him.
Yes.
Because He cares for you. And I was just curious, I'll take your answer off the air, but I was just curious, from a practical standpoint, I've said that to people to try and encourage them a number of times, but I was just wondering what your thoughts on where that, with that is, from a practical standpoint, like how does one cast their cares upon the Lord? And sure. Like I said, I'll take your answer off the air. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. How does one cast his cares on God? Well, you do that not only by praying. Of course, Philippians 4 talks about casting all your cares on him, for he cares for you. You don't just pray. In addition to praying, you have to trust. If you pray, you have to realize that you are turning it over to God. What you're doing is committing it to him. It's like if you find that you've got a roof leak and you don't know how to fix roofs, you might be in despair because your roof leak is going to destroy your house if it doesn't get fixed. But if somebody comes along who's an expert and you say, listen, would you fix this roof for me? I'll pay you so much money. And they say, sure. And then you kind of give the job to them. Well, once you've asked them to do it, you have to trust that they'll do it right, or else you'll be nervous the whole time. If you think you hired someone who's incompetent, you're not going to be relaxed. But if you think you've hired somebody who knows what he's doing, then you just kind of let it be his problem, not yours. It's your task is to make sure somebody's there on the job who can do it. And that's, of course, what we do with God. We put God on the task by prayer. Now, I have to say that when you do hire someone to fix your roof, of course, there's something expected of you also. In that case, you're expected to pay him. There's, turning it over to him, it means that you have to be prepared to pay him. If you're not ready to pay him, then you can't hire him and he won't do the job. Likewise, we don't have to pay God, but we do have to do something in order to really experience the peace of God that Paul talks about. We have to trust him. We ask him, and in doing so, we're turning the task over to him, the problem. And by the way, our lives are full of problems, and one of the biggest problems we have is that we think we can handle them, and we usually try ourselves, and once in a while, God, just in order that we'll trust him, will throw something our way that's beyond our ability, so we just have to say, wow, I just have to trust God, as if that's the last resort. Actually, trusting God should be our first resort, but that also should mean we should do what we can. So if we have, for example, financial worries or family problems or problems at work, relational problems with the neighbors or whatever our problems are, those can give you a lot of stress. Those can make you stress out and even have perhaps panic attacks and just be nervous. But turning it over to the Lord doesn't mean you don't do anything. It means that you turn it over to God to resolve, but you also do whatever your part is in the situation. Maybe you could do something to reconcile with your neighbor. Maybe there's someone who can help you plan your finances in such a way to meet your needs in some way. Change jobs or something like that, or change financial managers. There are things you can do and should do. Anything you can do to direct your life toward a good result, well, you should do that. But you know that you're not really in control of everything, of your life or anything like that. God is. And therefore, you trust him that once you've been doing your best. Yeah, Keith Green had a song that had the refrain was, you keep doing your best and pray that it's blessed and he'll take care of the rest, which is kind of a easily remembered little refrain. And it sounds shallow, but it's not shallow. It's actually quite profound. You do what you can, you commit it to God in prayer, and you rest in his competence. You figure, okay, as long as I'm doing what I know God wants me to do, there's nothing more that I can do or should do. And therefore, the rest is on him. And if it's on him, then that's his problem, not mine. That's what it means to cast your cares on God. And, of course, Peter said to cast your cares on him in 1 Peter chapter 5. In Philippians, it said we should not be anxious for anything, but by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, make our requests known to God. And so turning something over to God is like turning over any task to anybody. Once you've turned it over, it's their task. But there may be something you're supposed to do in the arrangement. And in the case of, the things in our lives that have become stressful, there are some of them that we can't do a single thing about. Health, for example, might be something that, no matter what we do, we can't change it. But the things we can do something about, we should, while we're still trusting that God working through us and beyond us is going to settle the matter in a way that he pleases. Now, you know, now when it comes to panic attacks, I'm not prepared to say that some of them do not have a physiological cause. You know, there may be something in the wiring of the brain. There may be some chemical issue. I don't know much about that. That's not my field. I don't know about the physiology of the brain. There may be someone, a doctor, who can find that for you. Most people, I think, when they do that, a lot of them think they should go to a psychiatrist. And, you know, maybe they should. But a psychiatrist is, if he can help you with a physiological problem, he only does it as a medical doctor. You can go to any competent medical doctor and have the test run to see if your thyroid's okay and if your blood sugar's okay and things like that, which, if they're wrong, can obviously have effects on your mood. But, you know, insofar as there's a spiritual dynamic, and I think there usually is, even if there is a physiological one, then I would suggest hand it over to God in prayer and then really trust him and just say, okay, it's in his. It's like when I don't know how to fix cars. When I finally break down and take my car to a garage, it's because I did finally break down. And so I did take it to the garage, and I just say, okay, when's it going to be ready? I'll come back 2 days from now. Okay, then I'll do it. In the meantime, I don't give it any thought, except to make sure it's on my calendar to go pick it up. But I don't think, boy, I wonder if he's fixing it right. I don't take it to him if I don't think he's going to know how to fix it right. I go to somebody I trust, and if I trust him, then I trust him. I just don't worry about it. So when you've handed something over to God, you trust him with it, and you rest in the fact that he's competent and that he's faithful. Those would be the main comments I would make in answering your question about how do you cast your cares on God. More could be said. By the way, I would highly recommend a book. I don't recommend books all the time. This is a book, a very old book from the 1800s, but it's still a very, very widely read book. It's written by a woman, a Quaker woman, actually, named Hannah Whitehall Smith. And it's got a title that put me off for a long time. I wouldn't read it for years because it sounded like a shallow book. It's called The Christian Secret of a Happy Life. That's The Christian Secret of a Happy Life. It's written by a woman. When I, you know, growing up, I saw it in bookstores and I thought, oh, it sounds like a, you know, self-help for bored housewives or something, you know. And so I didn't have any interest in it. But somebody gave it to me at a time when I was going through some pretty deep stuff in my life and said, you have to read this. So I did. And I was amazed. I've reread it several times, maybe 10 times, and I've recommended it to many people, and they always say, wow, that really helped. And what you're talking about, panic, anxiety, things like that, that would be among the things that I think you could find help with in a book like that. It's called The Christian Secret of a Happy Life. The woman who wrote it is Hannah Whitehall Smith. She was, in her own day, in the 19th century and early 20th century, a very well-known Christian speaker and writer. Of course, she's been long dead now. But I do recommend the book. All right, that could help you even beyond perhaps what I've said here on the radio. Let's talk to Evan from Salt Lake City. Evan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Howdy. So if there's any crying in the background, I apologize. My daughter woke up early from her nap, so I'm back here feeding her Cheerios.
Oh, okay.
Last week I had called in, and we had talked about something different. You had invited me last week that if I felt so inclined to explain why I had chosen to leave Mormonism, if I ever wanted to share that, that I could come on your program and do that, and if the offer is still open.
Yes, but I would hope you'd be brief. Yeah, I don't want to turn the whole program over to it, but if you can give me some kind of a encapsulated version, sure.
I mean, I would say that while the particulars of my particular journey are probably my own, the broad strokes are very similar in that it all just comes down to objective history.
Mm-hmm.
The Mormon Church has a very specific truth claim. And it's very adamant on it that basically either they are the one true church, everyone else in error, or they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look into history and you find out the things that Joseph Smith has actually said, the things that he actually did, things he actually preached, the people he defrauded, you sit there and you go, oh, this is falsifiable, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even worse, in my opinion, is when you look at Brigham Young, and, you know, the man was a warlord.
Oh, yeah, he was horrible. A murderer, a mass murderer, yeah.
A horrible murdering warlord. I mean, mm-hmm. His reign in Utah was closer to a Muslim caliphate than it was
a reign of terror, yeah, it was.
And I spent a lot of, and I guess the point is, I guess I spent a lot of years trying to put myself in mental pretzels to try and put up with it. And when I finally allowed myself to entertain the thought that maybe I could take things at face value and say, you know what, the Book of Mormon is preposterous. The Book of Abraham is preposterous.
Yeah.
The polygamy is preposterous. That when I gave myself permission to do that, and I had, and I got the blessing from my wife to do that,
you know, that's
you know,
very
all,
good.
It all just fell apart.
That's a very good expression, that you gave yourself permission to look at it objectively. Because people who are in cults, many times they do not give themselves permission because they're afraid. Well, many times people are held into cults by fear. Now, obviously, some people are held in cults because they haven't decided that there's enough evidence against them to leave them. But even when they do find very damning evidence against their group, there's a fear that rises up. There's a great deal to be lost if you've been raised in a Mormon community and you're in Utah, Salt Lake City, especially a Mormon in Salt Lake City, I would think. But, I mean, your friends, your family, you know, all your associations, and frankly, what you've invested in. You've invested in your Mormon identity. And when you come to adulthood, apparently you're already married, too, at the time. I mean, you've really invested a lot of years and your identity in this. So it's a very hard, it's a scary thing to think, wow, if it isn't true?
And the way that it's structured is that every step you go up, the commitment goes up.
Mm.
You know, they talk about families can be together forever. When you look at it objectively, and that's not a promise. That's a threat. What that's really saying is, if you leave us, your family's going to fall apart, and you won't be with them forever. And you won't be with your, I mean, it's awful. It's terrible. I mean, and I guess I would just leave with this, because my daughter, I don't want to take up all your time, my daughter's getting fussy.
Okay.
But I would say this, if you have a Mormon friend and you're trying to get them out of Mormonism, it sounds counterintuitive to tell a Christian to not use the Bible, but a Mormon isn't going to care about the Bible.
Yeah.
You need to send them to Mormon apologetics sites. Nothing will destroy a Mormon idea of Mormonism more than looking at Fair Mormon or Mormon Think, somewhere where they try to explain away. Because a lot of them are probably not going to know that the Book of Abraham, for instance, is nonsense and not at all translated.
Right.
Until they go to an apologetic site where an apologist will tell you, well, that's true, but let me explain why that's okay. Or Joseph Smith was a pedophile, but let me explain to you why that's okay. If they see it from actual Mormon sources, in fact, there's even some, you know, the Mormon Church was forced to publish some gospel topic essays, which they buried on their website. But if you can convince them, look, the URL on this says LDS.org. This is from your church. That's really where it's going to come. That's really, if you want to make headway, that's how you do it. I don't mean to dissuade people from using the Bible, but I'm just simply saying that.
I know that you weren't brought out of it by the Bible, because you actually left Mormonism and you became, as you by your own testimony, an angry atheist for a while, which is something you're only recovering from now, right?
And I mean, I didn't grow up in Utah. I actually grew up in New York, so I actually knew quite a bit of this history before my actual conversion process. I was born into the church, but I didn't much mind until my senior year of high school.
I see.
That helped to kind of prepare me for a lot of things people bring up. They're like, oh, I already knew that because I knew that from before I even bought into them. I've always liked the Bible, but I never really paid it much mind in Mormonism outside of, oh, look at this. This supports what we say, and if this doesn't, oh, well, then we were told it would, so it's not that big a deal.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that testimony. My lines are full, and I really need to move along, but I do, I'm glad you shared that with us.
Yeah. I hope that's helpful to anyone who has a friend that they are trying to help.
All right. And we'll look forward to hearing from you in the future.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Okay, let's talk to Brian from Wisconsin. Brian, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hey,
my question is about Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 and 7, with the binding and loosening of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess, is it your opinion that those are like chronological events where Satan's going to be, he's bound now, and then he's going to be released at before the second coming?
Or that is my general view. I know some people who have credibly suggested that his being loosed has already happened in modern history, but I don't know that I would take a stand for that. There are people who think that Satan has now been loosed just since maybe the 19th century, but I won't go into that right now because I'm not prepared to defend that. I mean, I could tell you why some people think that, but it's not necessarily a view I'm going to stand by. My understanding is that the binding of Satan in Revelation 20 took place when Jesus was here the first time, and the loosing of Satan for a little while takes place a little while before the second coming. Now, that little while, I don't know how long that is. It could be a century or more. It'd still be a little while compared to the longer period. Or it could be only a few days or weeks or a year or so. You know, we don't know how long a little while is. But the time between the binding and the loosing of Satan, it would comprise, in my understanding, the majority of the church age. Now, of course, people have trouble with more than one aspect of that. One of them is that it says it's 1,000 years, and certainly the majority of the church age is longer than that, that Satan does not appear to be bound, even now or at any time in the church age, because he's been active. That, too, is something, an obstacle to explain. So there are problems with it, but in answer to your question, yes, I believe that the chapter 20, I think, moves chronologically from the earliest events recorded to the later events in it. Now, I don't think the whole book of Revelation does that. I don't think overall the book of Revelation is chronological. I think it's made up of individual, discrete visions that are, each of them is chronological in its own framework. Each one is a different depiction of a story. And in the stories, I think they do progress from the beginning of those stories to the end chronologically, but more or less. But I don't think the whole book is necessarily arranged in a chronological arrangement.
Okay. So in the sense that he's bound, now it's so that he cannot deceive the nations.
Right.
So I take that as when he's released, he'll be able to deceive the nations. And then.
Right. It says when he's released, he goes out and deceives the nations again. Yeah.
So that's, I mean, it sounds like there'd be worldwide persecution at that time.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Because he's described as bringing all the nations of the earth against the beloved city, which is the church, and besieging it sounds like a time of global persecution of church.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, then it sounds like that's, as far as I can see, the last prediction of before the second coming that's not been
probably so
not happened
probably so yeah assuming it has not happened. Yeah, I mean, because I'm assuming the loosing of Satan will result in global persecution. It may take another form. It may just be in terms of global deception that encroaches upon the church, so that, you know, it may not necessarily be in the form of violent persecution. It could be, or it could be simply, you know, Satan is loose to deceive the nations, and that deception even takes hold in the church. One could argue that that has happened, and therefore maybe Jesus would come any time. But I'm not standing by that either. I don't think I know exactly what Satan being loosed is going to look like.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Okay, Brian, good talking to you. Thank you for your call. All right, our next caller is Mike from Massachusetts. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for having me. I had a quick question about, I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it's the Christian organization, and it's called the Brethren.
Your phone just cut out when you were telling me what it's called. What is it called? Are you back?
Oh, it's called the Brethren.
Oh, the Brethren, yeah. Well, there's more than one group called Brethren. There's, of course, the Plymouth Brethren. There's Brethren in Christ. There's Mennonite Brethren. There may be yet another group that just calls themselves Brethren, and I'm not sure I wouldn't be so familiar with them, but
okay.
What do you know about them?
If you could tell me a little bit more about them.
Well, unless I know what group they are, I wouldn't be able to, but what do you know about them?
Well, my boss is, he has a church in his basement, which, I mean, there's something wrong with that, but he also, he practices, well, I found out today he practices a closed Lord's table.
A closed communion, uh-huh.
Yeah, like the elders.
Yeah.
Have to make sure you're not worthy, because obviously none of us are worthy of.
Right. Well, you know,
I mean, that's
I know that Darby started a branch of the Plymouth Brethren that were called the Exclusive Brethren, and
What's his name?
John Nelson Darby.
Yeah, that's the commentary that he's.
Okay. So would they identify themselves as Plymouth Brethren or Exclusive Brethren, or do you just call themselves the Brethren?
I think they'd call themselves the Brethren.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of respectable people who have been in the Brethren denomination, including F.F. Bruce, who is one of the greatest New Testament commentators of the 20th century, W.E. Vine, who wrote Vine's Dictionary of Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words and so forth. These were guys in the Plymouth Brethren. Actually, George Mueller, one of my heroes in the 19th century, was a Plymouth Brethren. And even Watchman Nee, a great hero, Christian martyr in the 20th century in China, had strong influence from the Brethren as well. So there's been some really good, remarkable people in the Brethren. I have some differences with them. But these differences are not so great as would make me think them as heretics or cultic or anything like that. The differences I would have with them might be along the same lines as I would have with maybe Baptists, a denomination I was actually raised in. For example, the Brethren don't believe in the gifts of the Spirit for today, and I would disagree with them biblically on that point. They are dispensationalists, which I'm not. In fact, John Nelson Darby invented dispensationalism, and it started in the Brethren movement. He was Brethren. They tend to be Calvinistic also. So they got several things about them I don't agree with. They would have a lot in common with John MacArthur, for example. John MacArthur is Calvinist, dispensationalist, and didn't believe in the gifts of the Spirit for today. And those are views that, now, John MacArthur's not in the Brethren, but those are views that he would feel very comfortable with that they have. And those would be the very issues I would have differences with them about.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you for calling me in. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Good to hear from you today. You know, we're going to take a break here in about a minute, and we'll come back and take some more calls. We have another half hour ahead of us, so don't go away, and don't stop calling in, because we even have a couple lines open now. The number is 844-484-5737. The reason we take this break is because some stations leave us at this point. They only carry the first half hour of the program. And we want to let those listeners who will not be able to hear the second half hour, we want them to know that we are listener supported, and they can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you want from the website, thenarrowpath.com, though everything that's available there is free at thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned, and we'll be back in 30 seconds.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and you'd like to bring them up for conversation, if you have a different viewpoint from the host and you'd like to bring that up for conversation, we welcome you to be a part of the show. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, it looks like our line's just filled up, so you might get a busy signal, but if you hold on to that number and call it in a couple minutes, you might find a line has opened up. And we're going to start talking to these callers right now to make that happen. Sandy from Everett, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Hopefully you can hear me. Thank you, Steve, for taking my call. I just have two quick questions, hopefully, for you. My first question, hopefully, it's an easy one. When Jesus taught the disciples how to pray, he said, let thy will be done. And so that, we could say that prayer has been prayed for over 2,000 years. But what evidence do we have that what's happened on earth or what's happening on earth today is a reflection of what happens in heaven?
Well, first of all, I believe that God reigns over all, you know, over history, but I don't think he micromanages everything. I think a lot of things, I think history is going the direction that is his will for it to go. But I believe there's a lot of things that happen that are not his will. And that's why we're supposed to pray for that, because not everything that is his will happens automatically. Certainly it cannot be said that God's will is done on earth to the extent that it is now done in heaven, because in heaven,
right,
his will is always done by all participants, where it's not true here on earth. So we are praying for something more than has been realized. Now, you say thousands of people for thousands of years have been praying that. It certainly doesn't look like it's been accomplished. But, frankly, there's a warfare going on, and our praying is part of our function in the warfare. Our prayers are not without resistance. Now, I actually think that although these prayers have been prayed many times, for example, through the medieval times, Roman Catholics have said the Our Father sometimes 20 times in order to absolve themselves from a sin, because the priest said, you know, just say Our Father 20 times. And they've said that prayer. But that doesn't mean they were praying. And, you know, to say a prayer doesn't mean you're really talking to God or communicating with God. A person can rattle off that prayer 20 times without having a single thought of God. It's just a memorized prayer. And I think a lot of people have prayed it with no more enthusiasm or sincerity than that. Of course, many do pray it sincerely. But, you know, I think that, you know, prayer is something that has to be persevered in, because the enemy perseveres in resisting it. The devil doesn't want God's will to be done, but God is stronger than the devil. But I believe our prayers move the hand of God. And if we have weak prayers, well, then God is, you know, God moves without the same dynamic power and strength as if we had strong, faithful prayers, I believe.
Okay.
I mean, Daniel was praying and partially fasting for 21 days, and an angel got through to him with the answer to his prayer, but announced to him, you know, I could have gotten here earlier. I was sent with this answer 21 days ago. The first day you started praying, I was sent from God. But there's this war going on up there. This guy called the Prince of Persia was resisting, and I had to fight him for a while, and then Michael came and helped me, and I got through. Obviously, God has the resources, but the resistance from the enemy requires sometimes that we have some determination to pray. I'd say that many Christians who are listening to right now, if I said, how's your prayer life? They might say, well, I pray before dinner. Well, that's good. You should pray before dinner. Do you pray at bedtime? Yeah, well, I pray at bedtime too. Well, good. Now, have you fasted and prayed for anything for 21 days? Now, some Christians have, but I'll bet most Christians have not. And so it takes somewhat more perseverance and focus in prayer if we're going to see the kind of resistance that the devil is bringing to us overcome, I think.
Well, that's hard to absorb. I totally understand, but it is hard to absorb in terms of the reflection of our prayer life. And I would be guilty of not being as persistent. And
Me too.
Ouch.
I have prayed and fasted for things, but I don't do it all the time. Yeah.
Right. Well, I haven't added fasting to my prayer life, so I'm just guilty on the accounts. The other question that I have for you has to deal with the Book of Revelations, particularly in Chapter 2, where it's talking about the various churches. Specifically, I hope I don't botch this up, but I think it's pronounced Thyatira.
It could be. I say Thyatira, but who knows?
Yeah. Okay. So that, to me, gives a specific description of a church, and we can look at today and see, okay, are there any women pastors, and, you know, think in terms of, okay, this is, the Book of Revelation says that this isn't right because this was prophesied that there shouldn't be this women pastors, basically. But my question is, when I step back and I reflect on all of the biblical accounts, and I look at the lateral distance, and I would say it's probably, and I'm going somewhere, give me a moment, the lateral distance of all of the events that took place in biblical times that were recorded would be less than, let's say, 2,000 miles, which the distance of the United States from West Coast to East Coast is probably around 2,600 miles. And so when I look at something specific as that particular church, and I think about, okay, in biblical times, there are people, there are other civilizations, other religions even existing during those times. Certainly Hinduism would be an example of that. So why wasn't John given a revelation of those other types of churches, or was more specific of other types of religions that could have gone on during his time that had been in existence for a while? And then fast forward, how come there's not a description of, let's say, the Mormon church as one of the churches, you know, where, well, I know Paul talks about...
So you're asking me, why didn't John write a letter to the Buddhists and to the Hindus?
Yeah,
and basically. And to the Mormons?
Or why wasn't he just given that vision that, okay, that what they believe in is certainly...
Buddhists,
balance of harmony.
Well, let me just say this. Buddhists and Hindus, if they want to, can read the vision he did receive. And then he wouldn't have to write a special one to them. It'd be the same vision. I don't see any reason for him to send a letter to those people, because those people wouldn't have a clue who he was. The seven churches he wrote to, he was an overseer of those churches. He was the apostle of the province of Asia Minor. And all these churches were clustered in that area and were under his oversight. And so he's writing to churches that know him and look to him as their leader. And that's no doubt why Jesus chose him to be the one to receive the message to send to them. Now, he could have written a letter to, the Aborigines in Australia, but it wouldn't have meant anything to them. For one thing, they couldn't read the language he wrote in. Neither could probably most Hindus or, for that matter, Buddhists. You know, Buddhists in Tibet and in, you know, India and Hindus, you know, in India and places like that. I mean, they wouldn't be able to read the language he could write in, nor would they have any reason to reach them. He's not writing an evangelistic book. What those people would need would be evangelism. They'd need to have the gospel preached to them. They don't need to have a description of the judgment of God coming on a rebellious city, which happened to be Jerusalem. They wouldn't have any, even probably, awareness of the existence of Jerusalem. So I think that would go a long way toward explaining why John didn't write to those people. Now, he didn't write to the Mormons because they weren't around. They came into existence in the 1800s AD And John was writing many centuries before that, so there were no Mormons to write to. He was writing to actual churches that were part of his oversight. And I think that's probably why he wrote to those ones instead of others. And none of the apostles wrote anything directed toward other religions. They were writing to the churches. They were writing to Christians. Hindus and Buddhists and false religions are not really part of the church. They're not Christians. So that'd be probably the major answer I would give. I appreciate your question, though, Sandy, both of them. Let's talk to Rod from Cincinnati, Ohio. Rod, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. I have a question for you. Hopefully you can talk some sense into me. I'm part of this men's group. I've been part of it for about a year. And I guess my question
I can't
is,
talk you out of that, can I?
What'd you say?
I can't talk you out of that, can I?
Hey, well, maybe so. You've talked me out of a lot of things in the past, so you may be able to.
Go ahead.
This may be a stupid point, but my wife thinks I'm being real nitpicky. But the bottom line is that what is the biblical context for oaths? At the beginning of this meeting, people like raise their hands or put their hands on their hearts or put their Bibles in the air, and we recite an oath. I'm not going to give you it all, but it just for the sake of time. But they say like, on my honor, I will do my best to dot dot dot. It's laden with scripture, 2 Timothy 2, I will love my wife as Christ loved the church, and et cetera, Ephesians 6, Philippians 4, and so forth and so on, Hebrews 10. So it's laden with scripture. On the surface, it sounds like it's a good idea, but I don't know. To me, it just seems so pretentious, everybody just puts their hands in the air, so to whom are they giving this oath? And based on my reading of the scripture, I'm just not sure how biblical that is. And so,
are they swearing by God or by anything in particular? They're just saying on my honor, which means, I'm putting my honor at stake here.
Right. It is. They do say on my honor, but
well, let me just say this: that when Jesus said don't swear an oath, I think this is often misunderstood. Some people think that Jesus meant you should not swear an oath because you're not in control of things enough to guarantee that you could keep it, and you don't want to swear an oath and not keep it, so you shouldn't swear one in the first place because you have no control over the future. There are some who think that's what he means. I see his train of thought there a little differently. He's talking to the Pharisees, he's not talking to the Pharisees, he's talking to the disciples about the Pharisees, how that the Pharisees had a system of oath-taking which in their society took the place of contracts. Today we would have to have it in writing. We have to have lawyers drop a contract, and we both sign the contract. Now we're bound. We can't get out of it. We've got a written contract. They didn't have written contracts back then like that. They had oaths, and they would bind themselves with an oath. And they would swear by something sacred, or at least something greater than themselves, as it says in Hebrews chapter 6. Man always swears by something greater than himself, and usually it was something sacred. And the idea was, just as these men have said, on my honor, they would be saying essentially on God's honor. That is to say, if I say on my honor, you can trust me about this, I'm saying if I don't do it, my honor is compromised. My honor is besmirched, and I don't want that, so I'll keep my oath, or my promise, I should say. But to say on God's honor, I swear by God, or I swear by Jerusalem, or I swear by something else sacred on a stack of Bibles. Basically, what you're suggesting is that you are involving the honor of that sacred thing, and that if you don't keep your promise, then you are you're besmirching and compromising the honor of God. Now, this is something that no sensitive Jew would ever do. That is, they would take an oath, but they wouldn't break it because they wouldn't want to bring down the honor of God. And that's what would hold them to it. Now, Jesus is saying the Pharisees actually had a variety of oaths. They might not swear by God, but they might swear by heaven and not use the word God, or even by earth or by Jerusalem. Now, we know from another passage in Matthew 23 that the rabbis had taught or knew among themselves some oaths that they didn't think would bind you, and some that would. they said, and Jesus points this out in rebuking them, in Matthew 23, he says, you say that if a man swears by the gift on the altar, he's not bound. I'm sorry, he is bound. But if he only swears by the altar, he's not bound. If he swears by the temple, he's not bound. But if he swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound. In other words, the rabbis very legalistically had made up a bunch of rules. If you swear by this, it's binding. If you swear by this other thing that sounds similar, it's not binding. And what that would mean is if you were a legal expert, you could take oaths that the less knowledgeable person would think you're being honest about, but you can break it and say, hey, I didn't swear by the gold of the temple. I only swore by the temple, buddy. Now, Jesus said, well, if you swear by the temple, or if you swear by Jerusalem, that's God's city. If you swear by heaven, that's God's throne. If you swear by earth, that's God's footstool. Even if you swear by your own head, in a sense, that belongs to God. You're not the one in control of that. You can't make one hair white or black. That's, in other words, you're swearing by something that's still in God's domain. And therefore, you can't avoid swearing by God. You can't use some alternative oath and say, well, I didn't swear by God. No matter what you swear by, it's as if you're swearing by God. So don't even swear. Just be honest. Now, he's not saying it's wrong to swear by God. He's saying, don't even mess with oaths. It gets too confusing when someone's thinking that some oaths are binding, some are not. Your word should be your bond. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. Don't require that you take oaths or that, you know, just be so honest that no one would ever dream of exacting an oath from you. They know that if you say it, you're going to do it. And there used to be in our society that code of honor where if a man would shake hands on something, they didn't have a signed contract, they just shook hands, and on their honor, they would keep it. Now, that's not, when Jesus says don't take oaths, he's not suddenly making it immoral to take oaths or something, a sin to take oaths. He's basically saying, don't bother with them, you don't need them. You shouldn't need them. You should be honest. You shouldn't have to say, I swear by God. You should just say, I'll do it, and your yes should be yes. So he's not really saying oaths are bad. He's saying the oaths as they had been used and that the disciples were familiar with from the Pharisees' practice, that had become a whole corrupted system. But it's not wrong to take oaths in itself, but you shouldn't need them. You should just be honest whether you take an oath or not. He's saying you should keep your word whether you made an oath or not. Don't even worry about whether you took an oath or not. I think
right.
That's me.
That's what I'm saying. So but what is the context then of for people putting their Bibles in the hand of a bunch of men and just saying, on my own, who are we talking to? I mean, are we swearing
well,
to each other?
Yeah.
Or, you know,
I think
it just
so.
Seems.
I think
I
so. I think what they're saying is we're entering. I've never seen this done. I've never known people who did this, so I can't give you the nuances or the intentions behind it. I'm not familiar with it. But it sounds to me like they're saying, we are agreeing together to keep each other accountable to this promise, that we will do such and such a thing. And, you know, you take an oath sort of like that when you get married. You say, you know, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, you're actually swearing by God in a sense that you'll forsake all others and cleave only to your wife and do the things you said you're going to do. The idea there is, in the case of a wedding and probably in the case of what they're doing, is basically saying, I'm saying this in front of everybody because that way if anyone catches me not doing it, you can say, hey, you said you'd do it, and we're all in this together. Anyway, it is a practice I'm not familiar with. I can't comment in detail on it because it's not something I'm familiar with, but that would be my understanding of it if I were to observe it. All right, let's talk to Linda from Detroit, Michigan. Linda, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. First time I'm hearing your broadcast, and I would like to know Genesis 4, 15, 16, where Cain is sent out of the presence of God, and he goes into the land of Nod. Mm-hmm. I haven't had a pastor be able to answer this to me. Where did the people from the land of Nod come from?
They came from the same place Cain did. Everyone came from one place. They all came from Adam and Eve. The reason Adam named his wife Eve, the Bible says, is because she was the mother of all living. So Adam was not aware of any other human beings on the planet. And the New Testament seems to indicate that he was right because he's said to be the one through whom the whole human race was adversely affected by the fall. So the Bible strongly suggests that Adam was the first and only man created from the dust. And God gave him a wife, and she was the mother of all who lived. So the people in the land of Nod were descended from them too. Now, here's what many people don't understand. You've got Cain killing his brother. Then you've got Cain being banished. And when Cain is banished, he complains, if anyone finds me, they'll kill me. And then, of course, he goes off to the land of Nod. He knows his wife and starts, he builds a city and things like that. Now, of course, until that point, we'd never heard that there was anyone else around besides Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel. Because as soon as Cain and Abel are born, who are apparently Adam and Eve's first children, the story then focuses on them. It doesn't continue to list all the children that Adam and Eve had in the interim. It talks about these boys who grew up, took on careers as farmer and as a herdsman, and then brought their sacrifices to God, and then the story transpires. Now, this happened in their mm-hmm. adult life. That means that we read about their birth in the beginning of chapter 4, and we read about something that occurs in their adult life as the story progresses. But what were Adam and Eve doing all the time while these boys were growing up? Well, they're having kids. I mean, God told them to be fruitful and multiply. And in Genesis chapter 5, verse 4, it says that Adam and Eve had sons and daughters. It doesn't say how many, but they had sons and daughters. We don't have the names of any daughters, and we only have the names of three of the sons. But they apparently had a lot of kids, and they would, because God told them, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. So they must have had a lot of kids. And they probably had them very soon after they were told to do so. Now, what that means is that Cain and Abel, if they were the first children, were growing up while other children were being born and growing up too. And so by the time Cain killed Abel, Adam and Eve probably had a fair number of kids. Now, how long had transpired? Well, we have an answer to that, because it says in chapter 5 of Genesis, Adam was 130 years old when he had a son named Seth. Okay? So mm-hmm. When Adam was 130 years old, he had a son named Seth. That means Seth was born, you know, almost 130 years after Adam and Eve. Now, he wasn't the next son born. But we read in chapter 4, at the end of chapter 4, that when Seth was born, Eve said this about him. She said, God has appointed him another instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. Now, what this would tell us is that Seth was the first son that was born after Cain killed Abel. He was not necessarily the first son born after Cain and Abel were born, but he was the first son born after Cain killed Abel, so that his birth was recognized as a replacement for the dead Abel. And I think that's mm-hmm. a fair enough inference. So that means Cain and Abel were probably born in the first couple of years of Adam and Eve's life. Seth was born when they were 130, which was right after Cain killed Abel. That means Cain and Abel were about 100, almost 130 years old when Cain killed Abel. And when Cain had to take a wife and go to another land, and he was afraid other people would kill him, well, Adam and Eve had been having kids for 130 years. They could easily have had 130 kids. They could have had hundreds of kids, because they could have had twins sometimes. They could have grandchildren and even great-grandchildren by then. So there could have been 1,000 people. There could have been more. And therefore, although the Bible doesn't care to give a full, you know, telephone book listing of everyone who was born to Adam and Eve, it only tells a few stories. But by the time Cain killed Abel, there was quite a population on the earth. And so he was able to choose a wife and go to a land and start a village, a town called Enoch.
Oh, I thank you. You've explained it a lot clearer than some of the answers I've gotten before. And I may have even heard it before, but you're making sense on that one. So is there any place in the Bible that it says that he was killed in a house that he built? Because he was supposed to wander. I heard that the other day, and I'm like, I don't remember seeing that in the Bible.
No, the death of Cain is not mentioned in Scripture. He's not mentioned. All right. Thank you for your call, Linda. I appreciate it. Okay, we're going to talk next to Carolyn from Black Diamond, Washington. Carolyn, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Steve. Do you have any thoughts on the age of children going overseas on a mission trip?
Like families taking their children with them?
No. This is her church is gathering up a group to take overseas, well, to Chile specifically.
Uh-huh. What age are the children? What age are the children?
Well, she won't be 12 until a month after she leaves.
That's pretty young. Yeah, well, in answer to your question, the Bible doesn't ever talk about children being missionaries. It doesn't say they can't be, but there's no suggestion that they ever were in the early church. Now, there are some factors to consider. One of them is that we are told to rear up our children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, and there might be some parents who think part of my child's spiritual upbringing will be I want them to get some hands-on opportunities to help some people in a third world country or something like that. I don't think of Chile as a third world country. I've been there a few times and it doesn't seem very third world, but it's more than where I live in Southern California. But a lot of times people think, well, it'll be good for my kids. And I think they're probably right that it would be good for them spiritually to have that experience. And so that could fall under the general rubric of rearing your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You might think, well, this would be part of my child's spiritual formation. Now, on the other hand, I wouldn't see the child in that case as really a missionary. I mean, if they're going there to sing with a group of singing children, or they're going to go help some old people, or they're going to help build something, I mean, I guess that's technically a missionary kind of thing to do, but that's not the kind of thing missionaries in the Bible did. I'm not saying it's wrong to do it. I'm just saying in the Bible, missionaries were apostles who went and they preached the gospel, worked miracles, and went to jail and things like that, got beaten up. I wouldn't want to send a child on that kind of a mission. But if it's a matter of just a child getting a chance to get their feet wet, serving in some practical and humble way some other people, I wouldn't see it as unscriptural, though it certainly has no scriptural precedent. I guess that's the best way I can put it. I hope that's helpful to you. I'm out of time today, I'm sorry to say. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday at this time. We pay for time on many radio stations. It's many thousands of dollars. Between $50,000 and $60,000 a month we pay to the radio stations. That's where all the money goes that we get. We don't give money to anyone, no staff, no payroll, nothing. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website if you want. Everything at the website is free. You don't have to donate, but if you want to, you can at thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Hope you have a wonderful weekend and join us again Monday. God bless you.
The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg is sponsored by The Narrow Path every weekday at 2 o'clock here on True Talk 800. Coming up, we have some Bible teaching from Pastor Ron Mell next in Heart of the Word.
There you are. I've got great news. When you use your Capital One Venture card to book and pay for a room on Hotels.com/venture, you'll earn 10 miles for every dollar you spend at thousands of hotels. Doesn't that sound amazing?
It does. Just like the smooth jazz in this hotel lounge.
Wow, Captain Obvious. I didn't realize you were such a jazz fan.
I have two loves in my life, this deal and the jazz tuba.
Clearly, it loves you right back. What's in your wallet?
Offer available through January 2020. Capital One Bank USANA.
There's a difference between do-it-yourself and do-it-for a living. At The Home Depot, we get that. And we're here to help pros get the job done with the products and brands you trust. Technology to keep your job on track. Job site delivery to save you time. And bulk pricing on over 4,000 items every day to save you money. When you've got a job, we're on the job. The Home Depot. More saving, more doing.
For years, you've anticipated moments of wonder, like events of the Old Testament, the life of Jesus, and the days of the early church. In Israel, the black and white pages of the Bible transform into powerful, living color. Now, picture this. Yesterday, you stood at the Sea of Galilee and were baptized in the Jordan River. Today, you'll explore the remains of Nazareth. Tomorrow, you'll visit Jerusalem, where every stone pathway leads you toward the life of Christ and the story of God's purpose on earth. on earth. These moments can be yours when you join Tony and Lois Evans for Experience Israel 2018, November 7th through the 16th. Come and experience the legendary land of Israel together. Join musical guest Anthony Evans and Meredith Andrews. Israel's Calling. For all the details, visit TrueTalk800.com. TrueTalk800.com or call 855-448-7226. Book your journey to Israel today.
KPDQ Portland, a service of Salem Media Group. Download the TrueTalk 800 app in the App Store or Google Play.
Moving into the 3 o'clock hour now, and time for some Bible teaching from Pastor Ron Mell. This is Heart of the Word.
People who arrive at their potential are people that know of God's faithfulness, but they are also people who realize the power of God.
Welcome to Heart of the Word, presented by Compassion Ministries, founded by Pastor Ron Mell. Hello, this is David Harms. I'm glad you could join us here on the Friday edition of the broadcast. Power is a significant word today. People talk about the power of God, the power of government, authority. There's nuclear power. I mean, there's all kinds of power. But in Genesis chapter 1, the first sin had to do with the lust for power. So we're going to talk about that today, not by going into Genesis, although we'll touch on that. We're going to be most